For our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service presents... This issue of the Indie Week. Kurt Benrud, substituting for John Federson this week, and our current issue dated June 29th, 2021. Before we begin, as John insisted, I want to thank the volunteer unpaid musicians who identify themselves as Alfred E. Newman and the Usual Gang of Idiots. Theirs is music to drive you mad, and we thank them for it. Diving into this issue of Indie Week, we have a news article by Jasmine Gallup titled, As Pride Month Wraps, What's the Landscape Like for LGBTQ plus People in North Carolina? She writes, After years of verbal attacks, disrespect, and misgendering, mechanic Jay Jones is nearly ready to quit the auto industry for good. I've spent so many nights driving home after work, bawling my eyes out from stress and feeling unheard, says Jones, who is a transgender man. It essentially comes down to, how much energy can I really spend on educating people who only see me as a negative? Jones's experience isn't uncommon in North Carolina. Across the state, LGBTQ activists are still entrenched in a battle to win one of the oldest and most basic rights in the United States, the right to live one's life without facing discrimination. But as advocates fight for equality and resist anti-LGBTQ laws passed by the state legislature, the world around them has become more tolerant, accepting, and loving of people who identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. The battle for equality. One of the biggest issues LGBTQ activists are tackling this year is the lack of a statewide non-discrimination policy. North Carolina is one of 27 states in which discrimination on the base of sexual orientation or gender identity is not prohibited. That means when it comes to buying a house, getting a bank loan, seeing a doctor, or playing on a high school sports team, there are no legal protections for LGBTQ people. While public employees have some legal options, private employees cannot sue for discrimination. For Jones, it means being a little more hesitant to report discrimination to human resources. Jones' current company has a strict non-discrimination policy, but in other places, I've had instances of going to HR and getting a whole lot of nothing back in terms of results, he says. Jones is non-passing, he says, which means when people look at him, they might see him as a different gender. He started working as a mechanic in his current position about 3 months ago, and since then, the issues with his manager have been nonstop, he says. After months of being misgendered, Jones decided to take a transfer and start work at a different company location. But he isn't hopeful about his next work environment being much better. If his next job doesn't work out, he plans to quit his career for good. If it is different, that'd be amazing. But I'm already throwing in the towel that it will be the same, Jones says. My dad is a technician, so he does trade work too, and it came down to, we want you to succeed, but if your mental health is suffering, leave. An ongoing fight. North Carolina is slowly moving past its legacy of anti-LGBTQ legislation. This year, in the wake of the expiration of a law banning local anti-discrimination policies for the LGBTQ community, 9 North Carolina cities approved such ordinances. Durham, Greensboro, and Chapel Hill are among those that now prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. That's a sign of progress for Kendra Johnson, Executive Director of Equality NC, whose nonprofit was a major part of the campaign lobbying for such legislation. Simply having a law prompts agencies to start collecting data on instances of discrimination, giving everyone a better sense of the problem, she told the Indy. Moreover, it elevates the conversation about the realities that LGBTQ people live, Johnson says, prompting a culture change. It prompts all of these systems that LGBTQ people and other minorities have routinely been shut out of to evaluate how it is that they need to adapt in order to create welcoming and affirming environments. In the state legislature, two anti-trans bills were introduced this session. The difference this year is that they haven't gone anywhere. Both bills, one that sought to limit medical treatments for transgender people under 21, and another that would have prevented transgender people from playing on sports teams consistent with their gender identity, died in committee 2 months ago. Republican leaders have admitted that they don't see paths forward for the bills, which Democratic Governor Roy Cooper would likely veto if they landed on his desk. Another reason for the death of such bills may be the backlash the legislature faced after it passed the infamous House Bill 2 in 2016. Also known as the Bathroom Bill, HB 2 prohibited transgender people from using restrooms consistent with their gender identity. 5 years ago, condemnation from North Carolinians and big companies forced a partial repeal of the law. Today, criticism is likely to be louder. A changing world. If nothing else, one thing that has changed in 5 years is public opinion. Nationwide, public support for LGBTQ rights is at an all-time high. In the U.S., 76% of Americans support laws that protect LGBTQ people from discrimination, according to a recent poll by the Public Religion Research Institute. Support for same-sex marriage also broke records this year, with 70% of Americans and a majority of Republicans in support, according to a Gallup poll. One reason for the increased support may be an increase in the number of people willing to speak openly about their sexuality and gender identity. Since 2012, the number of Americans identifying as LGBTQ almost doubled, going from 3.5% to 5.6%, according to the Gallup poll. One in six adult members of Generation Z identify as something other than heterosexual, the Gallup report stated. Numbers may be even higher among people under age 18 who were not included in the poll. One such North Carolinian is 14-year-old Blaine Hedge, who is transgender. Blaine grew up in a conservative Christian household where being gay was not okay, he said. Since he came out, however, his parents have grown more open-minded. I kind of changed their perspective, Blaine says. My dad used to be really transphobic because he's into psychology and neuroscience, and being transgender just doesn't fit. When Blaine came out, his dad and mom were willing to learn, he says. They don't always understand, but they're supportive. Coming out, they were just kind of like, okay, you're still our child. I've told them about my experiences, Blaine said. My dad says we're all going on a journey, and with me, transitioning. We'll see what happens. Avery Burnett, 15, identifies as pansexual and non-binary. Avery realized their orientation during quarantine and came out to their parents a few months ago, they said. Avery's mother, Joy Burnett, wasn't familiar with the words pansexual or non-binary, she says, but it's made sense when they, that is Avery, explained it. It's something we're still working on, says Avery's dad, Daniel. For Johnson, who has been fighting to make LGBTQ voices heard for decades, seeing the next generation speak so openly about their gender and sexual orientation is encouraging. The more people who come out, and the more people who you know are LGBTQ, that begins to change public opinion, she says. It's harder to discriminate against your parent, your sibling, your aunt, your coworker that you love. You want them to enjoy equal rights. Next up is an article by Sara Pequeno. She writes, Surrey County made national news for its commissioner's conservative showmanship. It's not the first time. A few weeks ago, a girl who went to a high school near mine messaged me with a link to a video of a Surrey County Board of Commissioners meeting. This is fucking terrible, she wrote. The May 17th video picks up an hour and a half in when the commissioners, all white men, start talking about how they don't want money for the public schools in the district to go toward diversity and equity training. This counterculture wokeism, left-leaning liberal Marxism, and the new America that's trying to be formed. I'm telling you, folks can't hide from this, Commissioner Van Tucker says. 10 minutes later, Commissioner Eddie Harris proposes that the group create grassroots change by removing the 12 Coca-Cola vending machines that operate in county offices to protest the soda company's statement against a law in Georgia that would make absentee voting harder and prevent folks from handing out water as people wait in lines at the polls. The board, in a 3-2 vote, decides to remove the machines. Harris acknowledges that they get their products from a local Coca-Cola distributor who would ultimately bear the weight of the decision, but says Coca-Cola needs to pay the price. Turns out this piece of political theater did ultimately hurt only the 37 people who work at Surrey County's Coca-Cola bottling plant and Coca-Cola Consolidated, its parent company in Charlotte. The global soft drink behemoth didn't even begin to feel the effects of a boycott in a North Carolina county with a population of less than 72,000. We have absolutely no control over their opinions or statements about any issue, and we don't do any business in the state of Georgia, Allison Patient, vice president of government affairs of the Charlotte-based bottling company, told the commissioners June 7th. My company, Coca-Cola Consolidated, has a policy to only speak out on public policy issues that directly relate to our business, like this one tonight. It took 3 days for the Mount Airy News to write a story on the commissioner's decision. A few days later, I got that DM. By June 2nd, national outlets took notice. Surrey County made headlines at The Hill and CBS, as well as conservative outlets like Fox News and The New York Post. Commissioner Harris went on Fox and Friends to speak on the group's decision. Residents at the June 7th meeting mentioned this during a public forum. I just want to ask what you are really doing to address the needs of the least of these in our community, Alexius Brown Lippitt told the commissioners. You talk about standing up to the cancel culture, yet you become the very same. You talk about representing your constituents, but while you brag on Fox News, some of your constituents are dying, while others are exhausting themselves to help the least of these. Multiple speakers mentioned Harris's own words about the opioid epidemic and its devastating effects on the county. A man asked what it would take for the commissioners to accept that the election was free and fair. All asked the commissioners to focus on what the community actually needs. Quite frankly, if you sit on the Board of Commissioners for Surrey County and you would refuse any company to bring economic development to our county, you are a moron, Wes Caudill told the board. At that meeting, in another 3-2 vote, the commissioners took back their previous declaration. Harris and Tucker dissented. This isn't the first time Surrey County has made national news for its conservative politics. In January 2017, a reporter from the Washington Post came to town to write about how Donald Trump had won over conservative Christians. In the story, former Mayor David Rowe made some remarks that would lead most elected officials to resign. When you're my age and you see an African-American boy with pants at their knees, you can't appreciate them, he told the Post. I'm worried about when a person chooses to dress like that. What kind of effect will that person have on society? Instead of resigning, Roe was elected to another term later that year. In January of this year, a Pilot Mountain couple stormed the U.S. Capitol alongside roughly 800 right-wing rioters. Both of them have been charged with entering or remaining in a restricted building without lawful authority, as well as with violent entry and disorderly conduct. And if you're fine going back a few years and stepping a few miles away, a Ku Klux Klan cross burning in Cana, Virginia, 10 minutes from Mount Airy, was the subject of a Supreme Court decision in 2003. Then there are smaller things. In 2020, Board Chair Larry Johnson signed on to a statement of understanding from the Surrey County NAACP that acknowledged the existence of systemic racism and made a commitment to do better. The mayors of Elkin, Pilot Mountain, and Dobson signed on too. The other four commissioners opposed Johnson's decision. "This commissioner does not believe that our country is systemically racist," Harris said at the time. There's the Confederate monument located next to the county courthouse, which was dedicated in 2005, just 140 years after the Civil War ended, or the reporter covering the Coca-Cola controversy for the Mount Airy News, formerly owned by the right-wing Civitas Media Group, who compared the murder of two journalists in Roanoke, Virginia, to the Charleston church shooting. And then the extension of the Barter Theater, one of the only year-round repertory theaters still standing, that was scrapped because local officials said it would be too expensive. Despite all this, Surrey County isn't as staunchly Republican as people may expect. In the November 3rd election, Democrats received about 25% of the vote in almost every race. Orange County also had a 75-25 split, with Republicans in the minority. Surrey County has more than 4,000 black residents and almost 8,000 Latinx residents. My family is included in that count, although we are white Latinx. Together, they make up about 15% of the population. In Forsyth County, a 45-minute drive and home to the closest Target, almost 41% of residents are black or Latinx. A Juneteenth festival took place in downtown Mount Airy earlier this month. There was a Black Lives Matter rally last year. These events do not absolve the racism and partisanship of our elected officials, especially as the local newspaper shares commentary from readers telling the public that black folks have an excuse for failure. But they represent glimmers of progress. Mount Airy, the biggest town in Surrey, was my only home until I moved to the Triangle for school. My parents still live there. Both sets of my grandparents moved there in recent years. I have a tattoo of Pilot Mountain, the first thing I see when I hit the county line, so that I would always take a piece of home with me. I don't know what would make my hometown more tolerant. Changing the direction of dying newspapers, or the weak organizational support for rural Democrats in Surrey and other small counties, or some act of God. I worry about the conservative feedback loop that only strengthens as people like me move away. I also see hope in the children and teens and supportive community members who don't want to put up with it any longer. In 2017, I wrote about the Washington Post story for a college media group and asked folks to expand their understanding of my hometown and all other small towns. 4 years later, I still wish for that, but I also wish for it to do the work to be the happy, friendly place it claims to be. And now an article from Elizabeth Thompson. As a blood shortage unfolds in North Carolina, many gay and bisexual men are still barred from donating. Despite a 2020 update to FDA guidelines allowing men who have sex with men to donate blood after 3 celibate months, many are still powerless to assist in the national blood shortage. This story was first published online at North Carolina Health News. Lee Storo was a proud regular platelet donor for years, a service to the community he began after a representative spoke to his biology class at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill about the importance of donating. But Storo became instantly ineligible when he had sex with a man. At the time, more than a decade ago, Storo was immediately barred from donating at all, regardless of how often or when he had had sex. From 1983 until 2015, the FDA recommended blood establishments turn away all men who had had sex with men after 1977. The rule was put in place to prevent the population hardest hit by the AIDS crisis from unknowingly donating blood containing the virus, as it became clear that the blood-borne disease could be spread between men who had sex with one another. As time went on, blood donations were screened more effectively, and many gay men began to practice safer sex. Nonetheless, the rule remained in place for decades. Frustrated about the FDA rules, Storo went to Washington to testify against them as an openly gay college student. He was the only witness without an academic title next to his name to testify in favor of ending the lifetime ban before a U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Blood Safety and Availability Advisory Committee meeting in June 2010. I was like a 20-year-old student and joke that my parents found out I have sex from MSNBC, Storo, now in his 30s, said, which is not how most people expect their parents to find out. Over a decade later, he is still advocating for any form of the blood ban to end as the executive director of North Carolina AIDS Action Network. The FDA lifetime ban ended in 2015 when it moved to a 12-month deferral period for men who have had sex with men within that time frame. In order to combat a shortage in the blood supply caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, the FDA relaxed restrictions in 2020 to include men who have not had sex with men for 3 months. Ironically, the pandemic guidelines made Storo eligible to donate platelets again for the first time in years through a combination of the loosening of restrictions and the pandemic limiting his interactions with others. I was glad to be able to get back, Storo said. Some of the staff were there from a decade ago, and it was kind of fun to get to see them. But as multiple blood banks plead with potential donors to give blood in emergency notices across the country, Storo can't help. He's ineligible again. The United Kingdom recently loosened restrictions on gay and bisexual men giving blood, allowing people who have had the same sexual partner for the past 3 months to donate blood in order to help address a shortage of blood due to the COVID-19 pandemic. As blood banks across the U.S. offer incentives to potential donors, such as Amazon gift cards, in order to encourage them to help address a severe blood shortage, advocates argue for the end of blanket bans for men who have sex with men. Potential harms. Advocates for people with HIV and AIDS argue that a blanket policy that bans a whole group of people adds to existing stigma. This continues to perpetuate the stereotype that the only people who get HIV are men who have sex with men, and that's simply not true, said Michael Powandl, development and communications coordinator at the Western North Carolina AIDS Project. And it also promotes stigma that every man who does have sex with men is virtually HIV positive, simply because of that. And obviously, that is not true either. HIV affects more than just gay men. While a 2018 CDC study found that 69% of new HIV diagnoses were among gay and bisexual men, 24% were among heterosexual people, and 7% were among people who inject drugs. A woman who is heterosexual, who has had multiple sexual partners in the past 3 months, is also at a high risk for STDs, said Kara McGee, a physician assistant at Duke Health, who specializes in infectious diseases and is an associate professor at the Duke University School of Nursing. Everyone, regardless of gender, is in fact susceptible to HIV, Poandl said. The science advances. Since the emergence of the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s, the FDA tightened restrictions on how men who have sex with men give blood, but experts and physicians argue that these restrictions are a vestige of the past. At the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, there was no test for HIV or AIDS, and scientists weren't even sure how it was transmitted, said Ayako Miyashita Okchoa, assistant adjunct professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, Luskin School of Public Affairs. The policy itself was a reflection of that, Miyashita said. It also obviously targeted specifically the populations that were hardest hit by HIV and AIDS, so that what we find is that over time, with improvement or the advances in the science, we see that policy is lagging. A lot has changed since the 1980s, including what we know about HIV transmission, the groups that are predominantly affected by HIV, and the efficacy of prevention measures, Miyashita said. While the policy has changed from a lifetime deferment of men who have had sex with men, its blanket deferment for any gay or bisexual man who has had sex in the past 3 months excludes men who are in monogamous relationships and doesn't differentiate between different types of sex, which vary in risk. The methods of testing the blood supply have also changed, McGee said. The methods that are used to screen blood supply now are nearly 100% sensitive, McGee said, which is very different from the type of testing that they used years ago. And so that really narrows the window period from time of infection to the time the test would turn out positive. Looking for a solution. Advocates and scientists calling for an end to the ban don't believe all gay men should donate or all people should donate blood. There are real risks that are associated with not identity but certain conduct, said Scott Schoetz, the former HIV project director at Lambda Legal, who is also someone with HIV. And so the policy, when it changes, will need to continue to address minimizing that. Many experts and advocates argue for an individual risk assessment of sexual behavior for all people. This process would not only allow gay and bisexual men who are not at risk for HIV to donate, but it would also screen out other people who are involved in risky behaviors. This process has been used in Italy since 2001, and there has been no significant impact on the amount of HIV in the population since then. While we say that we really can't compare one country to another, because each country has their own processes, protocols, and tracking system, Miyashita said, I think that it gives us good insight into what we can expect if we do modify our own policies here domestically. The FDA ruled out changing its guidelines to an individual risk assessment due to insufficient information on the validity of questions on monogamy and safe sex practices. It has funded the Assessing Donor Variability and News Concepts in Eligibility study with Vitalant, One Blood, and the American Red Cross to explore alternatives to the deferral policy for men who have sex with men. The study is designed to assess if the questions related to behaviors may be effective in distinguishing between gay and bisexual men who have recently become infected with HIV and those who do not have HIV infection, said Red Cross spokesman Rodney J. Wilson. If this pilot study shows promising results, the next step may be a larger study to test these questions. Schoetz advocates for a shorter deferral period based on the individual risk assessment. The policy has always been designed to assess very recent infections that would not show up on such tests, Schoetz said. Making the perfect policy is tricky, Storrow said, but the existing one reinforces these really dated beliefs about gay men and their sexuality, that gay men are dirty, that they're unclean. Addressing the blood crisis. North Carolina is one of many states which currently face a severe blood shortage. Compared to 2019, the Red Cross has seen demand for red cells from trauma centers grow by 10% in 2021, it said in a statement. The shortage is due to a rise in trauma cases, organ transplants, and elective surgeries. People who had waited to have their surgeries until the pandemic improved now need more blood since their diseases progressed while they waited for surgery, and hospitals are seeing more trauma and emergency visits and more overdoses. Reducing the deferral for men who have sex with men is an important advance in our efforts to achieve a blood donation process that treats all potential donors with equality and respect and ensures that a safe, sufficient blood supply is readily available for patients in need, the Red Cross said in a statement. The Red Cross has updated its screening process to allow men who have not had sex with other men in the past 3 months to donate. However, donors who were deferred before due to the previous policy for men who have sex with men will have to be evaluated for reinstatement, a process that could take time since it involves many potential donors. The Blood Connection, an organization with centers in South Carolina, Georgia, and North Carolina, has faced extremely low donor turnout for the past 3 months, spokeswoman Allie Van Dyke said in a statement. Due to international regulations it is required to follow, the Blood Connection's deferral period is 4 months, but the change in guidelines from the previous 12-month deferral widens the pool of people who are able to donate blood, which is extremely important right now, Van Dyke said. McGee has received messages from Duke asking her to donate blood as the shortage worsens. We're in the middle of a critical blood shortage, McGee said. It's frustrating that we have these sort of blanket bans to keep a lot of people who are willing from donating. And now another article that was first published online at North Carolina Health News. This is by Greg Barnes, and it's titled, North Carolina Petition to Curb Carbon Dioxide Emissions Advances. The state is considering whether to join an initiative that has significantly reduced carbon dioxide emissions from power plants in other eastern states. A rulemaking petition aimed at reducing heat-trapping carbon dioxide emissions from North Carolina's power plants has made its way to the full North Carolina Environmental Management Commission. Last week, the Commission's Air Quality Committee recommended that the full Commission approve joining the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or RGGI, a cooperative effort among 11 states from Maine to Virginia that use the initiative to cap and reduce power sector carbon dioxide pollution. The commission will have the final say on whether to join RGGI, which statistics show has reduced power plant emissions of carbon dioxide by 47% over the last decade through cap and trade agreements among the participating states. The commission is expected to consider joining RGGI at a special meeting on July 13th. North Carolina probably could not become a member state until January 1st of 2023 because of regulatory processes that have to occur first, state officials said at last week's meeting. The recommendation from Air Quality Committee came the same day that Republican lawmakers released proposed legislation aimed at transitioning away from coal-fueled power plants to natural gas plants. Environmental groups criticized the measure and the reported lack of transparency in its development. urgent action needed. The petition to join RGGI was filed by the Southern Environmental Law Center on behalf of environmental groups Clean Air Carolina and the North Carolina Coastal Federation. We filed this petition because North Carolina needs to take urgent action to reduce carbon pollution from power plants, given the harm underway from climate change in our communities, Gudrun Thompson, an attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center, said in a statement. This rule will push dirty coal generation off the power grid, protecting the people and communities of North Carolina from air pollution while moving our state toward a clean energy future. The RGGI initiative puts an annual cap on carbon dioxide emissions from power plants, a cap that diminishes over time. Power companies can buy carbon dioxide allowances that RGGI makes available at auction for their share of the pollution. Some of that money is returned to the participating states, which use it for clean energy and energy-efficient projects. In North Carolina, the money could be used to reduce electric bills, though officials say it is likely that customers would see a small increase from RGGI before any decrease is realized. The threat of carbon dioxide and air pollutants. Burning fossil fuels not only produces carbon dioxide, but other pollutants that affect human health. The World Health Organization estimates that outdoor air pollution results in the deaths of as many as 4.2 million people annually. Multiple analyses from the past year point to air pollution's role in increasing the rate of death for people infected with COVID-19, particularly for those living in neighborhoods with high burdens of pollution, such as near highways and industrial facilities. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, carbon dioxide trapped in the Earth's atmosphere absorbs and radiates heat. Over time, carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases have tipped the Earth's energy budget out of balance, raising the Earth's average temperature and contributing to an increase in sea levels and more intense storms and flooding. Last year, North Carolina broke almost every heat record. Under Governor Roy Cooper, the state has set a goal of reducing carbon dioxide emissions from the power sector by 70% by 2030 and carbon neutrality by 2050. Duke Energy, the state's leading energy company, has a similar goal to reduce its carbon dioxide emissions. Proponents and critics. Proponents of RGGI say it is an effective tool to help reach those carbon dioxide reduction goals. We're already watching tropical storms form even though hurricane season just started, Todd Miller, executive director of the North Carolina Coastal Federation, said in a statement. It's imperative to act to reduce carbon pollution so that our coast is less vulnerable to extreme weather, and this vote is a good first step in that direction. But not everyone is sold on RGGI. During the Air Quality Committee meeting, attorney Fern Patterson spoke on behalf of the owners of Charlotte Pipe and Foundry, a family-operated business since 1901. Patterson argued that it's not clear whether RGGI has actually led to carbon dioxide reductions, and she questioned whether the rulemaking process is lawful in this instance. She also said the Biden administration has vowed to fight climate change, and the state should wait to see what comes forward. Medical marijuana bill passes in Senate committee. This article is by Rebecca Schneid. Dubbed the NC Compassionate Care Act, Senate Bill 711, which passed on a voice vote in the state's Senate Judiciary Committee this afternoon, would make North Carolina the 37th state in the country to legalize marijuana use for residents with debilitating medical conditions. It's the first time in North Carolina that a medical marijuana bill has been co-sponsored by powerful Senate Republicans, as well as Senate Democrats. Senator Bill Rabun, Republican of Brunswick, the chairman of the Senate Rules and Operations Committee, is joined by Senators Paul Lowe, Democrat of Forsyth, and Michael Lee, Republican of New Hanover, as primary sponsors. SB 711 still places heavy limitations on who would have access to medical marijuana within the state, but it mandates that anyone who has a debilitating medical condition or anyone who is a registered caregiver can receive a registry ID card to obtain the drug. Today's committee hearing began with statements from members of the committee. Senator Natasha Marcus, Democrat of Mecklenburg, noted that, though she is still dissatisfied with the bill's restrictions, she knows that a compromise must happen and is grateful that the bill is moving forward. "We don't want to continue to make criminals out of caregivers and patients and war veterans," she said. Republican Senator Kathy Harrington from Gaston held back tears as she discussed her own personal connection to the bill. Her husband was recently diagnosed with multiple myeloma, and medical marijuana would have been helpful as he went through cancer treatment. "If you had asked me 6 months ago if I would have been in favor of this bill, I probably would have said no. But life comes at you fast," she said. Public speakers were also allowed to address the committee. The first few speakers opposed the bill, citing the public health risks of marijuana and stating that passing the bill would open a Pandora's box for more destructive drugs. Chris Suttle went fully in the other direction, calling the bill an insult to North Carolinians for the continued limitations it continues to impose on medical cannabis use. Suttle says he was diagnosed with a brain tumor 4 years ago, and that medical marijuana is the reason that he is alive. "This is not the legalization that we deserve in the state that we love," Suttle said. Following comments from 11 speakers, most in support of the bill, the committee passed the bill on a voice vote to applause from the large audience of constituents who had come to speak and watch. It heads to further committees for consideration before it could be brought to the Senate floor this session. And Yan-Ki Xu gives us an article titled, "E-Cigarette Manufacturer Juul Agrees to Pay $40 Million to Settle Lawsuit Over Advertising Practices." This story first published online at NC Policy Watch. North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein announced Monday that his office settled a lawsuit in state court with vaping manufacturer Juul. And Juul, by the way, is spelled J-U-U-L. His office was the first in the nation to sue the company in 2019, claiming that it violated the state's Unfair or Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Today, because of Juul, thousands of kids in North Carolina are addicted to nicotine, putting their long-term health at risk, Stein said at a press conference Monday. Juul sparked and spread a disease, the disease of nicotine addiction. They did it to teenagers across North Carolina and this country simply to make money. Their greed is not only reprehensible, it's unlawful, and that's why I took action. Under the settlement, Juul cannot participate in outdoor advertising near schools or on public transit or sponsor advertisements at sporting events and concerts. The company also cannot pursue influencer advertising, which taps influencers for a company's marketing campaign, often on social media. Juul will be responsible for monitoring third-party social media content by underage teenagers promoting its products. Previously, Juul agreed to stop selling non-tobacco, non-menthol e-cigarettes of flavors not pre-cleared by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, according to a statement from the company. Stein said mint, mango, and creme brulee flavored e-cigarette products typically attract teenagers. "Importantly, we look forward to working with Attorney General Stein and other manufacturers on the development of potential industry-wide marketing practices based on science and evidence," a Juul statement said, adding it supports the AG's plan for funding public health research. Stein said his office required Juul and retailers to only sell their vaping devices to adults and to use a more stringent age verification system, including scanning the barcode on IDs. The $40 million payment will come in 6 installments over 6 years and be used for programs that help teenagers quit e-cigarettes and prevent them from starting to use these products. The state will release related documents from the lawsuit in July 2022. And the next article is by Thomas E. McDonald. It's called, An Attacker Killed a Cyclist on a Raleigh Greenway Last Summer. A year on, no one has been charged. Nearly a year has passed since an unknown assailant ambushed and fatally attacked a 57-year-old biker along the Raleigh Greenway. Now, 2 months from the first anniversary of that brazen attack on Chauncey Wynkoop Depew Jr., investigators hope that bringing the case back to the public spotlight will jog someone's memory and lead to an arrest. So far, no one has been charged. The attack happened around noon on August 20th along Walnut Creek Trail near the 1800 block of South Saunders Street, where Depew was riding his Kona trail bike. The man, known as Chip, had recently become a grandfather, according to his obituary. He was excited to share his many passions with his grandson, just as he had done with his children, it reads. Frederick Lowe, Jr., a 39-year-old JetBlue pilot, was biking along the trail when he happened upon Depew shortly after noon and called 911. Lowe told the Indy that he was riding eastward on the trail, heading down a descending turn when he first saw Depew's bike and blood on the ground. Depew was also on the ground a short distance away. I ran over and asked him, Hey, buddy, are you okay? Lowe said. He was conscious and making inaudible noises. Lowe said Depew's head was bloodied and there were scuff marks and blood all over his body. The airline pilot, who rode the trail once or twice a week at the height of the pandemic, said he first thought Depew had taken a nasty fall owing to a blind spot on the descending turn that gives way to a 4-foot retaining wall. I thought he had wiped out in the turn and hit the wall, Lowe said. Nothing stuck out to show that he was attacked. Lowe said a Raleigh detective contacted him a couple of hours later and told him the wounds inflicted on Depew's body indicated he was attacked. Lowe noted that the Greenway is a place often frequented by families with children, and he's grateful that he found him, not someone riding the trail with young ones. I wouldn't want little kids to come across what I saw, he said. Paramedics rushed Depew to Wake Med Hospital, where he later died of his injuries. Days after Depew's death, members of the Raleigh City Council rejected a police department request for a new park and greenways patrol unit that would have begun this year. The request called for 6 dedicated officers and a sergeant to supervise the unit at a cost of just under $580,000. The request for a dedicated police presence along the Greenway system was granted earlier this month, however, when the City Council, by a 6-2 vote, approved a nearly $5 million increase in the police department's budget that included funding for a Greenway patrol team. On August 30th, about 130 cyclists with Oaks and Spokes, a biking advocacy group, held a memorial ride in Depew's honor. The cyclists gathered at Dorothea Dix Park to begin the 6-mile ride, which included a stop at the place where Depew was attacked. Jennifer Wagner, chair of the city's Parks, Recreation, and Greenways Advisory Board, told the Indy in an email that even though Depew's slaying was an isolated incident, the city council asked her board, along with the Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Commission, to confer and offer a safety review and report on the Greenway system late last year due to the Depew attack and other concerns. Wagner said the discussions resulted in recommendations covering trail safety, maintenance, and wayfinding signage, and those recommendations were approved by her board on June 17th. Crime, as well as collisions and other potential hazards on the Greenway, were discussed, wrote Wagner, who added that the police department was also involved in the meetings and that officers offered insight into safety and best practices. With the City Council's decision to add 7 officers specifically to parks and greenways, we hope the police presence will increase on greenways, Wagner said. In addition, there are greenway volunteers who monitor activity and safety on the greenway. This program was less involved during COVID-19, but is picking back up again, and they are always looking for volunteers. Attempts to reach Depew's family members for comment this week were unsuccessful. According to his obituary, Depew was born in Tucker, Georgia, graduated from the College of Engineering at Georgia Tech, and worked in the engineering field for over 2 decades. The obituary notes that Chip was admired for his ability to live in the moment and encouraged everyone to live life to the fullest. He will always be remembered for his brilliant mind, inquisitive spirit, and willingness to lend an ear and give advice. Raleigh Police spokeswoman Donna Maria Harris told the Indy that the investigation of Depew's slaying continues, and police are urging anyone with information that might assist the investigation to contact Raleigh Crime Stoppers at 919-834-HELP. That's 919-834-HELP, or by visiting RaleighCrimeStoppers.org. And now an op-ed piece by Yasmin Floden Ali. The GOP is mischaracterizing critical race theory to suppressive ends. During the Red Scare of the 1950s, labeling a person a communist was a surefire way to blacklist them. These days, critical race theory is the new boogeyman. Republicans invoke critical race theory at every turn, insisting that it is rife with indoctrination and bias, with no attention to the actual body of work that makes up the theory. In May, the North Carolina House voted to pass House Bill 324, which seeks to curtail K-12 educators' ability to teach about race in public schools. Republican House Speaker Tom Moore claimed that the bill fights back against critical race theory. 20 such bills have been introduced in legislatures across the country. In early June, at the North Carolina Republican Annual Convention, former President Donald Trump called for a ban on critical race theory in the federal government and workplaces. North Carolina Republicans in Congress, including U.S. Senator Tom Tillis, are now introducing a bill to ban the 1619 Project from being taught in K-12 schools, also characterizing it as an example of critical race theory. Yet few people really know what critical race theory is. Across the political spectrum, the actual theorists and their ideas are rarely cited. Critical race theory is an academic framework that first developed in the late 1970s, largely in the context of law schools, that seeks to analyze U.S. law as it intersects with race and challenge certain approaches to social justice. Professor and lawyer Kimberly Cranshaw coined the term intersectionality in response to court cases that dealt with discrimination, yet failed to consider the ways that different forms of oppression intersect. For example, in one case, a company reasoned that they could not be charged with discrimination against their employees who were black women on the basis that they hired and retained black men and white women. The Combahee River Collective Statement, written primarily by Barbara Smith, Beverly Smith, and Demita Fraser, is often cited as another work foundational to critical race theory. The collective was formed by a group of black socialist feminist lesbians who felt that in their work as activists in various movements, aspects of their identities had been marginalized. In their joint statement, the collective coined the term Identity Politics, and argued that coalition building with an eye towards the connections among issues was necessary for successful organizing and real change. Critical race theory has been influential, broadly speaking, in the way that we view movements and identify formation. But it is questionable how directly the theory is making its way into classroom discussions about race. Our state's legislature would like to prevent all education about race, with or without critical race theory. North Carolina's House Bill 324 bans schools from teaching that the United States was created by members of a particular race or sex to oppress members of another race or sex. This is a blatant attempt to whitewash history. Teaching that many of the founders of the United States were slave owners who did not believe that non-white men deserved rights is not an engagement with critical race theory. It's a statement of fact. And now a few responses to the article about David Sacchino's book about the 1898 Wilmington coup, Wilmington's Lie. Readers were dismayed that they had never learned about such a significant event in the state's history in school. One response, I first learned about it in the Story of North Carolina exhibit at the NC Museum of History about a decade ago. I was so surprised something so huge was left out of the state history curriculum. Also, I'm a graduate of UNC Wilmington and was completely floored to discover what occurred in our backyard without anyone mentioning a word throughout the entire 4 years that I was there. And another, I grew up in Wilmington and never had heard of the Wilmington Massacre until there were a series of commemorations in 1998. The bottom line? They didn't leave it out of our history books accidentally. Uh-oh, that's my signal from Alfred E. Newman and the usual gang of idiots. They want me to end this broadcast. So be it. But remember, every session of Indie Week is available in podcast after the initial Friday broadcast. Just visit www.ncreadingservice.org, click Listen, click Skip to Podcasts, click Independent, and then click the link at the bottom of the page. I'm Kurt Benrute, substituting for John Federson, and we both thank you for joining us for this episode of Indie Week. Please join us for future broadcasts. North Carolina Reading Service thanks you for listening in.